I know that. That's why I'm here. I haven't a clue what happened to her, and I don't trust the cops to bother their arses finding out. I need a hand here, Melda. She shouldn't have been killed. That's dirty, that is. Rosie never did anything to anyone. She only wanted... Imelda went silent, smoking and watching her fingers twist through a hole in the threadbare sofa cover. But I could feel her thinking, and I didn't interrupt. After a while she said, I thought she was the one that got away. I raised an inquiring eyebrow. There was a faint flush on Imelda's worn cheeks, like she had said something that might turn out to be stupid, but she kept going. Look at Mandy, right? The spitting image of her ma. Got married as fast as she could, quit working to look after her family. Good little wife, good little mammy, lives in the same house. I swear to God she even wears the same clothes her ma used to wear. Everyone else we knew growing up is the same. Image of their parents, no matter how loud they told themselves they'd be different. She mashed out her smoke in a full ashtray. And look at me. Where I've ended up. She jerked her chin at the flat around us. Three kids, three dads. Mandy probably told you that, did she? I was 20 having Isabel. Straight onto the dole. Never had a decent job since, never got married. Never kept a fella longer than a year. Half of them are married already, sure. I'd a million plans when I was a young one, and they came to fuck all. Instead, I turned into my ma. Not a peep out of me. I just woke up one morning and here I am.
I flipped two more smokes out of my pack, lit Imelda's for her.
Thanks.
She turned her head to blow smoke away from me.
Rosie was the only one of us that didn't turn into her ma. I liked thinking about her. When things weren't great, I liked knowing she was out there. In London, or New York, or Los Angeles, doing some mad job I've never heard of.
The one that got away. I said, I didn't turn into my ma. Or my da, come to that. Imelda didn't laugh. She gave me a brief look I couldn't read. Something to do with whether turning into a cop counted as an improvement, maybe. After a moment she said,
Shania's pregnant. 17. Not sure who the da is.
Even Scorcher couldn't have turned that one into a positive. I said, at least she's got a good mammy to see her through.
Yeah,
Imelda said. Her shoulders sagged a notch lower, like part of her had been hoping I would have a secret fix to this.
Whatever.
In one of the other flats, someone was blasting Fiddy Scent, and someone else was screaming at him to turn it down. Imelda didn't seem to notice. I said, I need to ask you one more thing. Imelda had good antennae, and something in my voice had tweaked them. The blank look slid back onto her face. I said, who'd you tell that me and Rosie were heading off?
I didn't tell anyone. I'm not a bleeding squealer.
She was sitting up straighter, ready for a fight. I said, never thought you were. But there's all kinds of ways to get info out of someone, squealer or no. You were only, what, 18, 19? It's easy to get a teenager drunk enough that she'll let something slip. Maybe trick her into dropping a hint or two.
And I'm not stupid either.
Neither am I. Listen to me, Imelda. Someone waited for Rosie in number 16 that night. Someone met her there, killed her stone dead, and threw her body away. Only three people in the world knew Rosie was going to be there to pick up that suitcase. Me, Rosie, and you. Nobody heard it from me. And like you just said yourself, Rosie had kept her mouth shut for months. You were probably the best mate she had, and she wouldn't even have told you if she'd had any choice. You want me to believe she went and spilled her guts to someone else as well, just for the crack? Bollocks. That leaves you. Before I finished the sentence, Imelda was up, out of her chair, and whipping the mug out of my hand.
The fucking cheek of you, calling me a mouth of my own house. I shouldn't have let you in the door, giving it all about calling in to see her old mate. Mate my arse, you just wanted to find out what I knew.
She headed for the kitchen and slammed the mugs into the sink. Only guilt gets you that kind of all-guns-blazing attack. I went after her. And you were giving it all about loving Rosie, wanting her to be the one who got away? Was that all a big load of bollocks too, Imelda, was it? You haven't a clue what you're talking about. It's easy for you swanning in after all this time, Mr. Big Balls. You're able to walk away whenever you like. I have to live here. My kids have to live here.
Does it look to you like I'm fucking walking away? I'm right here, Imelda. Whether I like it or not, I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah, you are. You get out of my home. Take your questions and shove them up your hole and get out.
Tell me who you talked to and I'm gone. I was too close. Imelda had her back pressed up against the cooker. Her eyes flashed around the room looking for escape routes. When they came back to me, I saw the mindless flare of fear. Imelda, I said as gently as I could, I'm not going to hit you. I'm only asking you a question. She said,
get out.
One of her hands was behind her back, clenched on something. That was when I realized the fear wasn't a reflex, wasn't a leftover from some arsehole who'd smacked her around. Imelda was afraid of me. I said, what the fuck do you think I'm going to do to you? She said, low,
I was warned about you.
Before I knew it, I had taken a step forward. When I saw the bread knife rising and her mouth opening to a scream, I left. I was at the bottom of the stairs before she pulled herself together to lean down the stairwell and shout after me for the neighbour's benefit.
And don't you bleeding come back!
Then the door of her flat slammed. Chapter 15. I headed deeper into the Liberties, away from town. The whole city centre was packed with Christmas shopping lemmings, elbowing each other out of the way in a frenzy to credit card everything they laid eyes on. The more overpriced, the better, and sooner or later one of them was going to give me an excuse for a fight. I know a nice man called Danny Matches who once offered to set fire to anything I ever felt needed burning. I thought about Faithful Place, about the avid look on Mrs. Cullen's face, and the uncertainty on Des Nolan's, and the fear on Imelda's, and I considered giving Danny a call. I kept going till I had walked off most of the urge to punch anyone who got too close to me. The lanes and the alleyways had the same look as the people at Kevin's wake, twisted versions of familiar, like a joke I wasn't in on. Brand new BMWs jammed together in front of what used to be tenements. Teenage Mas yelling into designer prams. Dusty corner shops turned into shiny franchises. When I could stop moving, I was at Pat's Cathedral. I sat in the gardens for a while, resting my eyes on something that had stayed put for 800 years, and listening to drivers work themselves into road rage as rush hour got closer and the traffic stopped moving. I was still sitting there, smoking a lot more than Holly would have approved of, when my phone beeped. The text was from my boy Stephen, and I would have bet he had rewritten it 4 or 5 times to get it just right. Hello, Detective Mackey. Just to let you know, I have the information you requested. All the best, Stephen Moran, Detective. The little beauty. It was coming up towards 5. I texted him back. Well done, meet you in Cosmos, ASAP. Cosmos is a shitty little sandwich joint tucked away in the tangle of lanes off Grafton Street. None of the murder squad would be caught dead in there, which was one big plus. The other was that Cosmos is one of the few places in town that still hire Irish staff, meaning none of them will lower themselves to look directly at you. There are occasions when this is a good thing. I meet my CIs there sometimes. By the time I got there, the kid was already at a table, nursing a mug of coffee and drawing patterns in a sugar spill with one fingertip. He didn't look up when I sat down. I said, good to see you again, Detective. Thanks for getting in touch. Stephen shrugged. Yeah, well, I said I would. Ah, are we having issues? This feels sleazy. I promise I'll respect you in the morning. He said, back in Temple Moor, they told us the Force was our family now. I paid attention to that, you know. I took it seriously. And so you should. This is your family. This is what families do to each other, Sunshine. Hadn't you noticed? No, I hadn't. Well, lucky old you.
A happy childhood is a beautiful thing. This is how the other half lives. What have you got for me?
Stephen bit down on the inside of his cheek. I watched with interest and let him work through the conscience thing all by himself. And finally, of course, rather than grabbing his knapsack and legging it out of Cosmos, he leaned over and pulled out a slim green folder.
The post-mortem, he said, and handed it over.
I flicked through the pages with a thumbnail. Diagrams of Kev's injuries jumped out at me. Organ weights, cerebral contusions. Not your ideal coffee shop reading.
Nicely done, I said, and much appreciated.
Summarize it for me. 30 seconds or less.
That startled him.
He had probably done family notification before, but not in full technical detail. When I didn't blink, he said,
Okay.
The deceased, your brother, he fell from a window, head first. There were no defensive injuries or combat injuries, nothing that would point to another person being involved. The fall was approximately 20 feet onto hard earth. He hit the ground just to one side of the top of his head, around here. The fall fractured his skull, which damaged his brain and broke his neck, which would have paralyzed his breathing. One or the other killed him. Very quickly.
Which was exactly what I had asked for, but all the same I almost fell in love with the overgroomed waitress for showing up right at that moment.
I ordered coffee and some kind of sandwich. She wrote down the wrong thing twice to prove that she was too good for this job, rolled her eyes at my stupidity, and nearly knocked Stephen's mug into his lap, whipping my menu away. But by the time she wiggled off, I had managed to unclench my jaw at least part way. I said,
"No surprises there. Got the fingerprint reports?"
Stephen nodded and pulled out another file, thicker. Scorcher had put some serious pressure on the Bureau to get results this fast. He wanted this case over and done with. I said, "Give me the good parts." The outside of the suitcase was a mess. All that time up the chimney rubbed off most of whatever was there before. And then we've got the builders and the family who...
Your family.
He ducked his head, embarrassed. There's still a few prints that match Rose Daly, plus one matching her sister Nora, plus three unknowns. Probably from the same hand and made at the same time, going by the position. On the inside, we've got more or less the same. Lots of Rose on everything that'll hold prints, lots of Nora all over the Walkman, a couple from Teresa Daly on the inside of the actual case, which makes sense, it used to be hers, and loads from all the Mackie family, mostly Josephine Mackie.
Is that, your mother?
Yep, I said. Ma would definitely have been the one to unpack that suitcase. I could hear her.
Jim Mackie, you get your dirty hands out of that yoke. That's knickers in there, are you some kind of pervert?
Any unknowns?
Not inside. We've also got, a few of your prints on the envelope the tickets were in.
Even after the last few days, I had just enough room for that to hurt. My prints from that gob-smackingly innocent evening in O'Neill's, still fresh as yesterday, after 20 years hidden in the dark, ready for the Bureau techs to play with.
I said,
"Yeah, you do. It didn't occur to me to wear gloves when I bought them.
Anything else?"
"That's it for the suitcase. And it looks like the note was wiped clean. On the second page, the one that was found in 1985, we've got Matthew, Teresa, and Nora Daly, the three lads who found it and brought it to them, and you. Not one print from Rose. On the first page, the one from Kevin's pocket, we've got nothing. Like, no prints at all, clean as a whistle."
"And the window he went out of?"
"Opposite problem. Too many prints. The Bureau's pretty sure we've got Kevin's on the top and bottom sashes, where you'd expect them if he opened the window, and his palm prints on the sill where he leaned out. But they won't swear to it. There's too many layers of other prints underneath. The details get lost. Anything else I might want to know about?
He shook his head.
Nothing that sticks out. Kevin's prints showed up in a couple of other places, the hall door, the door of the room he fell from, but nowhere you wouldn't expect. The whole house is covered in unknowns. The Bureau's still running them. So far, a few have popped up, guys with minor records. But they're all local fellas who could have been in there just messing about, years ago for all we know.
Nicely done, I said.
I squared off the edges of the files and stashed them in my case. I won't forget this. Now let's hear you summarize Detective Kennedy's theory of what happened.
Stephen's eyes followed my hands.
Tell me again how this is ethically okay.
I said, it's ethically okay because it's done and dusted, kid. Summarize.
After a second, his eyes came up to meet mine. He said, I'm not sure how to talk to you about this case.
The waitress smacked down my coffee and our sandwiches and flounced off to get ready for her close-up. We both ignored her.
I said, you mean because I'm connected to just about everyone and everything involved?
Yeah. That can't be easy. I don't want to go making it worse.
And bedside manner, too. Give the kid 5 years and he'd be running the force.
I said, I appreciate your concern, Stephen, but what I need from you right now isn't sensitivity, it's objectivity. You need to pretend this case has nothing to do with me. I'm just an outsider who happened to wander in and needs briefing. Can you do that?
He nodded.
Yeah. Fair enough.
I settled back in my chair and pulled my plate towards me.
Wonderful. Hit me.
Stephen took his time, which was good. Drowned his sandwich in ketchup and mayo, rearranged his crisps, and made sure he had his thoughts in order. Then he said,
okay. Detective Kennedy's theory goes like this.
Late on December 15th, 1985, Francis Mackey and Rose Daly are planning to meet at the top of the fateful place and elope together. Mackey's brother Kevin gets wind of it.
How? I didn't see Imelda pouring her heart out to a 15-year-old kid.
That's not clear. But obviously someone did, and Kevin adds up better than most people. That's one of the factors backing up Detective Kennedy's theory. According to everyone we've talked to, Francis and Rose had kept the elopement totally under wraps. No one had a clue what they were planning. Kevin, though, he was in a privileged position. He shared a room with Francis. He could have seen something.
My girl Mandy had kept her mouth shut.
Let's say that's out. There was nothing in that room to see.
Stephen shrugged.
He said, I'm from the North Wall. I'd say the Liberties work the same way, or anyway they did back then. People live on top of each other. People talk. There's no such thing as a secret. I've got to tell you, I'd be amazed if no one knew about that elopement. Amazed.
I said, fair enough. We can leave that part vague. What happens next?
Concentrating on giving his report was relaxing him a little. We were back in his comfort zone. Kevin decides to intercept Rose before she meets Francis. Maybe he arranges to meet her, or maybe he knows she'll need to pick up her suitcase, but either way, they meet up, most likely somewhere in number 16, Faithful Place. They get into an argument. He snaps. He grabs her by the throat and hits her head off the wall. From what Cooper says, that part would have taken no time, a few seconds maybe. When Kevin gets his temper back, it's too late.
Motive. Why would he intercept her to begin with? Never mind argue with her.
Unknown. Everyone says Kevin was pretty attached to Francis, so it could be he didn't want Rose taking him away. Or it could be sexual jealousy. He was just at the age to cope really badly with that. She was gorgeous by all accounts. Maybe she'd turned Kevin down, or maybe they'd had something on the side.
Stephen suddenly remembered who he was talking to.
He blushed, shut up, and shot me an apprehensive look.
I remember Rosie, Kevin had said. That hair and that laugh, and the way she walked.
I said, the age gap was a little wide for that. We're talking 15 and 19, remember? But he could have fancied her all right. Keep going.
Well,
The motive doesn't even have to be anything big. I mean, as far as we know, it's not like he was planning on killing her. It looks more like it just happened. When he realizes she's dead, he drags her body to the basement, unless they're down there already, and puts her under the concrete. He was strong for his age. He'd worked part-time on a building site that summer, fetching and carrying. He would have been able for it. Another quick glance. I picked Ham out of a back tooth and watched him blandly. At some stage in all this, Kevin finds the note Rose was going to leave for her family, and he realizes he can use it to his advantage. He stashes the first page and leaves the second where it is. The idea is, if Frances leaves anyway, everyone will basically tumble to the original plan. The two of them have gone off together and the note's for her parents. If Frances ends up going home when Rose doesn't show up, or if he gets in touch with his family at some stage, everyone will think the note was for him and she's gone off on her own. And for 22 years, I said, that's exactly what happens. Yeah. Then Rose's body turns up. We start investigating, and Kevin panics. According to everyone we've talked to, he was pretty stressed out the last couple of days, and getting worse. Finally, he can't take the tension anymore. He digs out the first page of the note from wherever he's been keeping it all this time. He spends one last evening with his family, and then he goes back to the place where he killed Rose and... well... he says his prayers and takes a header out of the top floor window. And justice is served. More or less, I guess. Yeah. Stephen watched me covertly over his coffee to see if he had pissed me off. I said, well done, detective. Clear, concise, and objective. Stephen let out a quick breath of relief, like he was coming out of an oral exam, and dove into his sandwich. How long do you think we've got before that turns into the official gospel according to Kennedy and both cases get closed? He shook his head. A few days, maybe. He hasn't sent the file upstairs yet. We're still gathering evidence. He's thorough, Detective Kennedy is. I mean, I know he has his theory, but it's not like he's just slapping it onto the case and throwing the whole thing away. He's talking like we, me and the other floaters, will be staying with murder for the rest of the week anyway. Which meant, basically, I had about 3 days. Nobody likes going backwards. Once this case was officially closed out, I would need to come up with notarized video footage of someone else committing both murders before anyone would reopen it. I'm sure that'll be a blast, I said. What do you personally think of Detective Kennedy's theory? That caught Stephen off guard. It took him a second to get his mouthful under control. Me? You, Sonny Jim. I already know how Scorcher works. Like I told you before, I'm interested in what you've got to offer, apart from your mad typing skills. He shrugged. It's not my job to... Yeah, it is. I'm asking you, that makes it your job. Does his theory float your boat? Stephen shoved more sandwich in his mouth to give himself time to think. He was watching his plate, keeping his eyes invisible. I said, yep, Stevie, you do indeed need to bear in mind that I could be biased as all hell, or crazed with grief, or just plain crazy to start with, and any or all of those could make me a very bad person to share your innermost thoughts with. But all the same, I'm betting this isn't the first time it's crossed your mind that Detective Kennedy might just be wrong. He said, it's occurred to me. Of course it has. If it hadn't, you'd be an idiot. Has it occurred to anyone else on your team? Not that they've mentioned. And they won't. They've all thought about it because they're not idiots either. But they're keeping their mouths shut because they're terrified of getting on Scorchy's bad side. I leaned in across the table, close enough that he had to look up. That leaves you, Detective Moran. You and me. If the guy who killed Rose Daly is still out there, no one's going after him except the two of us. Are you starting to see just why our little game is ethically okay? After a moment, Stephen said, I guess. It's ethically just peachy all over, because your primary responsibility here isn't to Detective Kennedy, or to me, come to that. It's to Rose Daly and Kevin Mackey. We're all they've got. So quit faffing around like a virgin clutching her knickers and tell me what you think of Detective Kennedy's theory.
Stephen said simply, I'm not mad about it.
Why not?
I don't mind the holes. No known motive, not sure how Kevin found out about the elopement, all that stuff. You'd expect gaps like that after this long. What's bothering me is the print results.
I had been wondering if he would spot that.
What about them?
He licked mayo off his thumb and held it up.
First off, the unknowns on the outside of the suitcase. They could be nothing, but if this were my investigation, I'd want to identify them before I close the case out.
I was pretty sure who had left those unknowns, but I didn't feel like sharing.
I said, so would I.
Anything else?
Yeah. The other thing is, right.
A finger went up.
Why no prints on the first page of the note? Wiping the second page makes sense if anyone starts getting suspicious and reports Rose missing. Kevin doesn't want the cops finding his prints on her goodbye letter. But the first page?
He takes it out from wherever he's been keeping it all this time. He's planning to use it as a suicide note and a confession, right?
But he wipes it clean and uses gloves to stick it in his pocket. In case what? Someone connects it to him?
And what does Detective Kennedy have to say about that?
He says minor anomaly, no biggie, every case has them. Kevin wipes both pages that first night, hides the first one away. When he takes it back out, he doesn't leave prints.
People don't always, which is true enough, except
we're talking about someone who's about to kill himself. Someone who's basically confessing to a murder. I don't care how cool you are. You're going to be sweating like a mother...
like mad.
And when you sweat, you leave prints.
Stephen shook his head.
That page should have prints, he said. End of story.
And he went back to demolishing his sandwich.
I said, just for fun, let's try something. Let's assume for a moment that my old friend Detective Kennedy is off base for once, and Kevin Mackey didn't kill Rose Daly.
Then what have we got?
Stephen watched me. He asked, are we assuming Kevin was murdered too?
You tell me.
If he didn't wipe off that note and put it in his own pocket, someone else did it for him. I'm going with murder.
I felt that sudden, treacherous flood of affection rush through me again. I almost got the kid in a headlock and tousled his hair.
Works for me, I said.
And what do we know about the murderer?
We're thinking it's the one person.
I sincerely hope so. My neighborhood may be a little on the freaky side, but I'm hoping to God it's not freaky enough to have two separate killers doing their thing on the one road.
Somewhere in the last 60 seconds since he started having opinions, Stephen had got a lot less scared of me. He was leaning forward, elbows on the table, so focused he'd forgotten all about the rest of his sandwich. There was a new hard flash in his eyes, harder than I would have expected from such a sweet little blushing newbie.
Then, going by Cooper, it's probably a man, aged between, say, late 30s and 50. So, he'd have been between his mid-teens and 30 when Rose died, and pretty fit then and now. This took a guy with some muscle on him.
I said, Rose did. Kevin didn't. If you'd found a way to get him leaning out that window, and he wasn't a suspicious type, one little shove would have been all it took, no muscle needed.
So, if our man was between 15 and 50 when he got hold of Rose, that puts him anywhere between late 30s and 70 now.
Unfortunately.
Anything else we can say about him that might narrow it down?
Stephen said, he grew up somewhere very near Faithful Place. He knows number 16 inside out. When he realized Rose was dead, he must have been big time shocked, but he still remembered those slabs of concrete in the basement. And from what everyone's telling us, the people who know number 16 are people who lived on or near Faithful Place when they were teenagers. He might not live there anymore. There's dozens of ways he could have found out about Rose's body showing up, but he did.
For the first time in my career, I was getting an inkling of why murder love their job the way they do. When undercovers go hunting, we'll take anything that wanders into our snares. Half the skill is knowing what to use as bait, what to toss back where it came from, and what to knock on the head and bring home. This was a whole different thing. These boys were the specialists called in to track down a rogue predator, and they focused on him like they were focusing on a lover. Anything else that wandered into their sights while they were trawling in the dark for that one shape meant sweet fuck all. This was specific, and it was intimate, and it was powerful stuff. Me and that one man, somewhere out there, listening hard for each other to put a foot wrong. That evening, in the very sad cafe, it felt like the most intimate connection I had. I said, "The big question isn't how we found out Rose had shown up. Like you say, probably everyone who ever lived in the Liberties got a phone call about that. The big question is how he found out Kevin was a threat to him after all this time. As far as I can see, there's only one person who could have made that clear to him, and that's Kevin. Either the two of them were still in contact, or they ran into each other during all the hoo-ha this weekend. Or Kevin went out of his way to get in touch. When you get the chance, I'd like you to find out who Kevin phoned in his last 48 hours, mobile phone and landline if you had one, who he texted, and who phoned or texted him. Please tell me I'm right in assuming Detective Kennedy's pulled his records. They're not in yet, but he has, yeah. If we find out who Kevin talked to this weekend, we find our man." I remembered Kevin losing the head and storming off Saturday afternoon, while I went to get the suitcase for Scorcher. The next time I saw him, had been in the pub. He could have gone to find just about anyone in between. Stephen said, "Here's the other thing. I think probably he's been violent. I mean, obviously he's been violent, but I mean more than just those two times. I think there's a good chance he has a record, or at least a reputation." "Interesting theory. Why's that?" "There's a difference between the two murders, right? The second one had to be planned, even if it was only a few minutes ahead of time, but the first one almost definitely wasn't." "So? He's older now, he's more controlled, he thinks ahead. The first time he just snapped." "Yeah, but that's what I mean. That's how he snaps. That won't change, no matter how old he is." I cocked one eyebrow. I knew what he meant, but I wanted to hear him explain it. Stephen rubbed clumsily at one ear, trying to find the words. "I've got a couple of sisters," he said. "One of them's 18, right? And if you annoy her, she yells loud enough that you can hear her right down the road. The other one, she's 20. And when she loses the head, she throws stuff at their bedroom wall. Nothing breakable, like, just pens or whatever. That's the way it's always been, ever since we were kids. If the younger one threw something one day, or the older one started yelling, or if either of them got violent with anyone, I'd be amazed. People snap the way they snap." I dredged up an approving grin for him. The kid had earned a pat on the head, and I was starting to ask how he snapped when it hit me. The sick, dull crack of Shay's head off the wall, his mouth falling open as he hung limp by the neck from Da's big hands. Ma screaming, "Look what you've done now, you bastard, you're after killing him." And Da's thick, hoarse voice, "Serve him right." And Cooper, the attacker caught her by the throat and slammed her head repeatedly against a wall. Something in my face worried Stephen. Maybe I was staring. He said, "What?" "Nothing," I said, swinging my jacket on. Matt Daly, flat and final. "People don't change." "You're doing a good job, Detective. I mean that. Get in touch as soon as you've got those phone records." "I will, yeah. Is everything?" I found 20 quid and shoved it across the table at him. "Sort the bill. Let me know right away if the Bureau turns up a match to those unknowns on the suitcase, or if Detective Kennedy tells you when he's planning to close out this investigation. Remember, Detective, it's down to you and me. We're all there is." I left. The last thing I saw was Stephen's face, watery through the glass of the cafe window. He was holding the 20 quid and watching me go, And he had his mouth open.
Chapter 16. I kept walking for another few hours. Along the way, I cut down Smith's Road past the entrance to the place, the way Kevin had meant to go after he dropped Jackie to her car Sunday night. For a good stretch of the way, I had a clear view of the top back windows of number 16, where Kevin had taken his header, and I got a quick over-the-wall glimpse of the first floor ones. After I went past the house, if I turned around, I got a full view of the front while I passed the top of Faithful Place. The street lamps meant that anyone waiting inside would have seen me coming, but they also turned the windows a flat, smoky orange. If there had been a torch lit in the house, or some kind of action going on, I would never have spotted it. And if someone had wanted to lean out and call me, he would have had to do it loud enough to risk the rest of the place hearing. Kevin hadn't wandered into the house because something shiny caught his eye. He had an appointment. When I got to Portobello, I found a bench by the canal and sat down long enough to go through the post-mortem report. Young Stephen had a talent for summarizing. No surprises, unless you counted a couple of photos that, in fairness, I should have been ready for. Kevin had been healthy all over. As far as Cooper was concerned, he could have lived forever, if he had just managed to stay away from tall buildings. The manner of death was listed as undetermined. You know your life is deep in the shit when even Cooper goes tactful on you. I headed back to the Liberties and swung by Copper Lane a couple of times, checking out footholds. As soon as it hit around 8:30, and everyone was busy eating dinner or watching telly or putting the kiddies to bed, I went over the wall, through the Dwyer's back garden, and into the dailies. I needed to know, fast, just what had happened between my father and Matt Daly. The thought of knocking on random neighbours' doors wasn't particularly appealing, and besides, given the choice, I go to the source. I was pretty sure that Nora had always had a soft spot for me. Jackie had said she lived out in Blanchardstown or somewhere, but normal families unlike mine pull closer when bad things happen. After Saturday, I was willing to bet that Nora had left her husband and her kid to babysit each other, and was spending a few days back under Mammy and Daddy Daly's roof. Gravel crunched under my feet when I landed. I stood still in the shadows, up against the wall, but no one came looking. Gradually, my eyes got used to the dark. I'd never been in that garden before. Like I told Kevin, too scared of getting caught. It was what you'd expect from Matt Daly. A lot of decking, neatly trimmed shrubs, labelled poles stuck in flowerbeds ready for spring. The jacks had been turned into a sturdy little garden shed. I found a darling wrought-iron bench in a conveniently shadowy corner, wiped it more or less dry, and settled in to wait. There was a light on in a first-floor window, and I could see a neat row of pine cupboards on the wall. The kitchen. And sure enough, after about 30 minutes, in came Nora, wearing an oversized black jumper with her hair pulled back in a rough bun. Even at that distance, she looked tired and pale. She ran herself a glass of tap water and leaned against the sink to drink it, staring blankly out of the window, her free hand going up to knead the back of her neck. After a moment, her head snapped up. She called something over her shoulder, gave the glass a fast rinse, and dumped it on the draining board, grabbed something from a cupboard, and left. So there I was, all dressed up and nowhere to go, until Nora Daly decided it was bedtime. I couldn't even have a smoke, just in case someone spotted the glow. Matt Daly was the type to go after prowlers with a baseball bat for the sake of the community. For the first time in what felt like months, all I could do was sit still. The place was winding down for the night. A telly threw stuttering flickers on the Dwyer's wall. Music was seeping faintly from somewhere, a woman's sweet, wistful voice aching out over the gardens. In number 7, multicoloured Christmas lights and pudgy Santas sparkled in the windows, and one of Sally Hearn's current crop of teenagers screamed, "No, I hate you!" and slammed a door. On the top floor of number 5, the epidural yuppies were putting their kid to bed.
Daddy carrying him into his room, fresh from the bath, in a little white dressing gown, swinging him into the air and blowing raspberries on his tummy. Mummy laughing and bending to shake out blankets. Just across the road, my Ma and Da were presumably staring catatonically at the telly, wrapped in their separate, unimaginable thoughts, seeing if they could make it to bedtime without having to talk to each other. The world felt lethal that night. Normally, I enjoy danger. There's nothing like it to focus the mind, but this was different. This was the earth rippling and flexing underneath me like a great muscle, sending us all flying, showing me all over again who was boss and who was a million miles out of his depth in this game. The tricky shiver in the air was a reminder. Everything you believe is up for grabs. Every ground rule can change on a moment's whim, and the dealer always, always wins. It wouldn't have startled me if number 7 had crumbled inwards on top of the Hearns and their Santas, or number 5 had gone up in one great woof of flames and pastel-toned yuppie dust. I thought about Holly, in what I had been so sure was her ivory tower, trying to work out how the world could exist without Uncle Kevin. About sweet little Stephen in his brand new overcoat, trying not to believe what I was teaching him about his job. About my mother, who had taken my father's hand at the altar and carried his children, and believed that was a good idea. I thought about me and Mandy and Imelda and the Dailies, sitting silent in our separate corners of this night, trying to see what shape these last 22 years fell into without Rosie somewhere out there pulling at their tides. We were 18, and in Galligan's, late on a Saturday night in spring, the first time Rosie said England to me. My whole generation has stories about Galligan's, and the ones who don't have their own borrow other people's. Every middle-aged suit in Dublin will tell you happily how he legged it out of there when the place was raided at 3 in the morning, or bought you two a drink before they were famous, or met his wife, or got a tooth knocked out moshing, or got so stoned he fell asleep in the jacks and nobody found him till after the weekend. The place was a rat hole and a fire trap. Peeling black paint, no windows, spray-stenciled murals of Bob Marley and Che Guevara, and whoever else the current staff happened to admire. But it had a late bar, more or less. No beer license, so you chose between two types of sticky German wine, both of which made you feel mildly poncy and severely ripped off, and it had a kind of live music lottery, where you never knew what you were going to get tonight. Kids nowadays wouldn't touch the place with someone else's. We loved it. Rosie and I were there to see a new glam rock band called Lipstick on Mars that she had heard was good, plus whoever else happened to be on. We were drinking the finest German white and dancing ourselves dizzy. I loved watching Rosie dance. The swing of her hips, and the whip of her hair, and the laugh curving her mouth. She never let her face go blank when she danced like other girls did. She always had an expression. It was shaping up to be a good night. The band was no Led Zeppelin, but they had smart lyrics, a great drummer, and that reckless shine that bands did have back then, when no one had anything to lose, and the fact that you didn't have a snowball's chance in hell of making it big didn't matter, because throwing your whole heart into this band was the only thing that stopped you being just another futureless dole bunny moping in his bedsit. It gave them something. A drop of magic. The bass player broke a string to prove he was serious, and while he was changing it, Rosie and I went up to the bar for more wine. "That stuff's poxy," Rosie told the barman, fanning herself with her top. "I know, yeah. I think they make it out of Benelin. Leave it in the airing cupboard for a few weeks and away you go." The barman liked us. "Poxier than usual, even. You got a bad batch. Have you nothing decent, have you not?" "This does the job, doesn't it? Otherwise ditch the boyfriend, wait till we close up and I'll take you somewhere better." I said, "Will I give you a smack myself, or will I just leave it to your mot?" The barman's girlfriend had a mohawk and sleeve tattoos. We got on with her, too. "You do it. She's harder than you are." He winked at us and headed off to get my change. Rosie said, "I've a bit of news." She sounded serious. I forgot all about the barman and started frantically trying to add up dates in my head. "Yeah? What?" "There's someone retiring off the line at Guinness's next month. My dad says he's been talking me up every chance he gets, and if I want the job, it's mine.
I got my breath back.
Ah, deadly, I said.
I would have had a tough time getting delighted for anyone else, especially since Mr. Daly was involved. But Rosie was my girl.
That's brilliant. Fair play to you.
I'm not taking it. The barman slid my change down the bar. I caught it.
What?
Why not?
She shrugged.
I don't want anything my dad gets for me. I want something I get myself. And anyway... The band started up again with a happy blast of drum overkill, and the rest of her sentence got lost. She laughed and pointed to the back of the room, where you could usually hear yourself think. I got her free hand and led the way, through the clump of bouncing girls with fingerless gloves and raccoon eyeliner, orbited by inarticulate guys hoping that if they just stayed close enough, they would somehow end up getting a snog.
Here, Rosie said, pulling herself up onto the ledge of a bricked-up window.
They're all right, these fellas, aren't they?
I said, they're great. I'd spent that week walking into random places in town, asking if they had any work going, and getting laughed out of just about every single one. The world's filthiest restaurant had had a kitchen porter gig open, and I started getting my hopes up, on the grounds that no sane person would want it. But the manager had turned me down once he saw my address, with an unsubtle hint about inventory going missing. It had been months since Shay let a day go by without some line about Mr. Leavensert, and all his education couldn't put a wage on the table. The barman had just taken the guts of my last tenor. Any band that played loud and fast enough to blow my mind empty was in my good books.
Ah, no, not great. They're all right, but half of it's that.
Rosie motioned with her wine glass to the ceiling. Galligan's had a handful of lights, most of them lashed to beams with what looked like baling wire. A guy called Shane was in charge of them. If you got too near his lighting desk carrying a drink, he threatened to punch you.
What? The lights?
Shane had managed to get some kind of fast-moving silvery effect that gave the band an edgy, sleazy, almost glamour. At least one of them was bound to get some action after their set.
Yeah, your man Shane, he's good. He's what's making them. This lot, they're all atmosphere. Knock out the lights and the costumes, and they're just four lads making idiots of themselves.
I laughed.
So's every band, sure.
Sort of, yeah. Probably.
Rosie's eyes went sideways to me, almost shyly, over the rim of her glass.
Will I tell you something, Francis?
Go on. I loved Rosie's mind. If I could have got inside there, I would happily have spent the rest of my life wandering around, just looking.
That's what I'd love to do.
Lights? For bands?
Yeah. You know what I'm like for the music. I always wanted to work in the business ever since I was a little young one.
I knew that. Everyone knew that. Rosie was the only kid in the place who had spent her confirmation money on albums. But this was the first time she had said anything about lighting.
I can't sing for shite, but... And the arty stuff wouldn't be me anyway. Writing songs or playing the guitar, nothing like that. This is what I like.
She tilted her chin up at the criss-crossing beams of light.
Yeah?
Why?
Because.
That fella's after making this band better. End of story. It doesn't matter if they're having a good night or a bad one, or if only half a dozen people show up, or if anyone else even notices what he's at. Whatever happens, he'll come in and he'll make them better than they would have been. If he's honest to God, brilliant at what he does, he can make them a load better every time.
I like that.
The glow in her eyes made me happy. Her hair was wild from dancing. I smoothed it down. It's good stuff, all right.
And I like that it makes a difference if he's brilliant at his job. I've never done anything like that. No one gives a toss if I'm brilliant at the sewing. As long as I don't make a bollocks of it, that's all that matters. And Guinness's will be exactly the same. I'd love to be good at something, really good, and have it matter.
I said, I'll have to sneak in backstage at the Gaiety and you can pull the switches. But Rosie didn't laugh.
God, yeah. Imagine. This here is only a crap little rig. Imagine what you could do with a real one, like in a big venue. If you were working for a good band that goes on tour, you'd get your hands on a different rig every couple of days.
I said, I'm not having you go on tour with a bunch of rock stars. I don't know what else you'd be getting your hands on.
You could come too. Be a roadie.
I like that.
I'll end up with enough muscles that even the Rolling Stones wouldn't mess with my mott.
I flexed my bicep.
Would you be into it?
Do I get to road test the groupies?
Dirt bird,
Rosie said cheerfully.
You do not. Not unless I get to ride the rock stars. Seriously, bud, would you do it? Roadie, something like that.
She was really asking. She wanted to know.
Yeah, I would.
I'd do it in a heartbeat. Sounds like great crack. Get to travel, hear good music, never get bored. It's not like I'll ever get the chance, though.
Why not?
Ah, come on.
How many bands in Dublin can pay a roadie? You think these lads can?
I nodded at Lipstick on Mars, who didn't look like they could afford their bus fare home, never mind support staff. I guarantee you, their roadie is someone's little brother shoving the drum kit into the back of someone's dad's van.
Rosie nodded.
I'd say lighting's the same. Only a few gigs going, and they're going to people who've already got experience. There's no course you can take, no apprenticeship, nothing like that.
I checked.
No surprise there.
So, say you were really into getting your foot in the door, right? No matter what it took. Where would you start?
I shrugged. Nowhere around here. London? Maybe Liverpool? England, anyway. Find some band that could just about afford to feed you while you learned the trade, then work your way up.
That's what I think, too.
Rosie sipped her wine and leaned back in the alcove watching the band. Then she said, matter of fact,
let's go to England, so.
For a second I thought I had heard wrong. I stared at her. When she didn't blink, I said,
are you serious?
I am, yeah.
Jesus, I said.
Serious now? No messing.
Serious as a heart attack.
Why not? It felt like she had set light to a whole warehouse of fireworks inside me. The drummer's big finishing riff tumbled through my bones like a great beautiful chain of explosions, and I could hardly see straight. I said, it was all that came out.
Your dad go through the roof.
Yeah, he would.
So?
He's going to go through the roof anyway, when he finds out we're still together. At least that way, we wouldn't be here to hear it.
Another good reason why England. The farther the better.
Course, I said.
Right.
Jesus.
How would we...
We don't have the money.
We'd need enough for tickets and a gaff and...
Jesus. Rosie was swinging one leg and watching me steadily, but that made her grin.
I know that, you big sap. I'm not talking about leaving tonight. We'd have to save up.
It'd take months.
Have you got anything else to be doing?
Maybe it was the wine. The room felt like it was cracking open around me. The walls flowering in colours I'd never seen before. The floor pounding with my heartbeat. The band finished up with a flourish. The singer whacked the mic off his forehead and the crowd went wild. I clapped automatically. When things quieted down, and everyone including the band headed for the bar, I said,
you mean this, don't you?
That's what I've been telling you.
Rosie,
I said. I put down my glass and moved close to her, face to face, with her knees on either side of me. Have you thought about this? Thought it all the way through, like? She took another swig of wine and nodded.
Of course.
I've been thinking about it for months.
I never knew.
You never said.
Not till I was sure.
I'm sure now.
How?
She said. The Guinness's job. That's what's after making up my mind for me. As long as I'm here, my dad's gonna keep trying to get me in there, and sooner or later I'll give up and take the job. Because he's right, you know, Francis. It's a great chance. There's people would kill for that. Once I go in there, I'll never get out.
And I said, and if we go over, we won't be coming back. No one does. I know that. That's the point. How else are we going to be together, properly like?
I don't know about you, but I don't want my da hanging over my shoulder, giving out shite for the next 10 years, wrecking our heads every chance he gets, till he finally figures out we're happy. I want you and me to get a proper start, doing what we want to do together, without our families running our whole bleeding lives. Just the two of us.
The lights had changed to a deep underwater haze, and behind me a girl started singing, low and throaty and strong. In the slow spinning beams of green and gold, Rosie looked like a mermaid, like a mirage made out of colour and light. For a second I wanted to grab her and crush her tight against me before she could vanish between my hands. She took my breath away. We were still at the age when girls are years older than guys, and the guys grow up by doing their best when the girls need them to. I had known since I was a tiny kid that I wanted something more than what the teachers told us we were meant for, factories and dole queues. But it had never hit me that I might actually be able to go out and build that something more with my own hands. I had known for years that my family was fucked up beyond repair, and that every time I gritted my teeth and walked into that flat, another little piece of my mind got strafed to rubble. But it had never once occurred to me, no matter how deep the crazy piled up, that I could walk away. I only saw it when Rosie needed me to catch up with her. I said, "Let's do it."
"Jesus, Francis, stall the ball. I didn't mean for you to decide tonight. Just have a think about it."
"I've thought."
"But," Rosie said after a moment, "your family. Would you be able to leave?"
We had never talked about my family. She had to have some idea. The whole place had some idea. But she had never once mentioned them, and I appreciated that. Her eyes were steady on mine. I had got out that night by swapping Shay, who drove a hard bargain, for all of next weekend. When I left, Ma had been screeching at Jackie for being such a bold girl that her da had to go to the pub because he couldn't stand to be around her. I said, "You're my family now." The smile started somewhere far back, hidden behind Rosie's eyes. She said,
"I'll be that anywhere, sure. Here, if you can't leave."
"No. You're dead right. That means we need to get out." That slow, wide, beautiful smile spread right across Rosie's face. She said,
"What are you doing for the rest of my life?"
I slid my hands up her thighs to her soft hips and pulled her closer to me on the ledge. She wrapped her legs around my waist and kissed me. She tasted sweet from the wine and salty from the dancing, and I could feel her still smiling up against my mouth. Until the music rose around us and the kiss got fiercer and the smile fell away. The only one who didn't turn into her ma. Imelda's voice said in the dark beside my ear, rough with a million cigarettes and an infinite amount of sadness. "The one that got away." Imelda and I were a pair of liars born and bred, but she hadn't been lying about loving Rosie, and I hadn't been lying about her being the one who had come closest. Imelda, God help her, had understood. The yuppie baby had fallen asleep in the safe glow of his nightlight. His ma stood up inch by inch and slipped out of the room. One by one, the lights started going out in the place. Sally Hearn's Santas, the Dwyer's telly, the Budweiser sign hanging crooked in the hairy student's gaff. Number 9 was dark. Mandy and Jer were snuggled up together early. Probably he had to be in work at dawn, cooking businessmen their banana fry-ups. My feet started to freeze. The moon hung low over the roofs, blurred and dirty with cloud. At 11 o'clock on the dot, Matt Daly stuck his head into his kitchen, had a good look around, checked that the fridge was closed and switched off the light. A minute later, a lamp went on in a top back room and there was Nora, disentangling her hair elastic with one hand and covering a yawn with the other. She shook her curls free and reached up.